The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1081. It's the 1st of June 2018. By the way, we've got a new podcast, not Business Lives, that's a new podcast as well, but we've got a new one called Moving Averages, and the series will feature expert market analysis, interviews with top traders and commentators, and much more. Go to voxmarkets.co.uk/moving averages. All right, on today's podcast I have George McDonough, CEO of KR1 PLC, the blockchaining investing company, which is on the NEXT exchange. And George talks about their final results, which is quite impressive, actually. Also on the podcast, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about vanadium. It's a very hot commodity at the moment. And also Bluebird Merchant Ventures, BMV. Plus, I have market analyst with Spreadex, Connor Campbell, talking about companies that will be releasing news next week, including AO World, that's AO Dot, WH Smith, that's SMWH, and Maitai Group, or MTO. Plus, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs, too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George McDonough, CEO of KR1 PLC, that's on the NEXT exchange. George, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've had your final results out for the year ended 31st December 2017. Some good figures in there. We'll get to that in a bit. Before we do, George, for people listening who haven't heard you before or new to the podcast, can you explain what KR1 is all about, please?
Yeah, we invest in early stage blockchain projects, most of which have what we call a token layer. So they're issuing tokens which have some sort of purpose to play in their platform. So we do a lot of due diligence on early projects. We decide which projects to back, and then we back them and help them through to their sort of public ICO. And the idea was to have a way in which the public markets could enter into the crypto space via a publicly listed share.
Yeah, and it's the cryptocurrency space has gone crazy gangbusters for the last 12 months. It's calmed down a little bit, hasn't it? I mean, Bitcoin, the biggest sort of currency there, was up at almost $20,000 for one Bitcoin. Now it's down to 7.5, and it's been down to 6. But let's go to the final results. And a cracking set of results, considering you are on about a 17 million market cap. So you've got realized gain on disposable of digital investments, 4.2 million. 16.2 million, I think, 11.6 million profit there. So total comprehensive income for the year, 11.6 million. So that's decent, George, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very pleased. Thank you. Yeah, no, it's been a fantastic year. We've managed to back some of the best projects in the space, and as the space has done very well and far more interest has come into the area, our projects have done very well, and we've managed those tokens very well on the markets as well. So altogether, yeah, very pleased.
So looking for, I mean, you say that that's profit for the year. Some of that is in unrealized, so that's still within the tokens. Is it still invested, some of that?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So some of that will go down. So the realized gain, the actual amount you made, is that 4.2 million, is it?
Correct.
That's very good. So, but looking forward, we know, you go big and you're one of the biggest investors in this space and you have that leverage, and it's been very active in the market almost. I don't know when the dip was, but when did sort of Bitcoin start coming off a bit, Joel? When did that start to die?
I suppose towards the end of January. I mean, if you go back many years, you can. There's always a dip for some reason. I think some people cite some US tax dates. Other people cite Chinese New Year. but to be honest, it's anyone's guess why it does that. But we saw a huge run up in November, December. And like always, where it goes exponential, you come down the other side. But if you zoom back to a sort of macro level, you can see the market cycles doing this almost since the beginning, really, from 2008, 2009. So one could say, well, this is just part of the adoption cycle.
Yeah. So, do you know what? Like I said, you've done very well for 2017, but that is now sort of like all final results is a historical document. So the important thing is now is going forward. Has it been as easy, or is it getting a bit harder out there to the back winners?
Well, it's a sort of mixed picture, really, because everything is correlated to Bitcoin currently because of how young the space is. And Bitcoin gets buffeted around in the sort of sentiment and the markets, and so everything sort of goes with it. But on the other side of things, and actually looking at backing early projects, it's never been better, really, because everyone's had a few years to make some mistakes, and the people who are coming through now are building similar projects in the sort of smart contract arena, but they're doing it in such a way that whereby they're rectifying mistakes that have happened previously. So we're seeing some very, very interesting projects coming through, and it's very exciting, especially in the what we call the consensus layer, where new types of consensus mechanisms are being designed in order to increase scaling and various other areas to the ecosystem that are being improved upon. So it's very exciting to be right in the middle of that, being able to pick the best projects.
Yeah, and I mean, do you know what? I mean, obviously, blockchain as a technology is hugely exciting and transformational. But I've seen varying views over the last 6 to 12 months, which range from it's the future, full stop, to it's just a load of hype and it's not. So, what are your thoughts? I mean, because I just see, I was on an email list for new ICOs, and I had to sort of unsubscribe because every day, several times a day, I was getting email about ICOs, and I thought, how can every company be making money like this? Because I don't know how many there are. There were a couple of thousand when I last looked. Currencies or tokens, and I thought, this can't be sustainable, can it? This amount of new ICOs coming to the market.
I'm in complete agreement. It's a rather strange scenario because you have a very effectively opaque technology, where what's actually happening under the hood isn't clear to everybody. So you have a lot of people. I don't know, I suppose you'd call it jumping on the bandwagon and raising money in this way. Really, tokens aren't about raising money as such. It's a sort of byproduct. What you're really doing is you're handing out a token that has a specific use case in the decentralized business that you're building. And in order to create a network and for that business to function, you have to get the token into lots of people's hands. Now, it just so happens that you can sell those tokens to the market. But unfortunately, there's a little bit more cramming in a token layer in order to make money rather than actually producing a decentralized business that requires tokens to be spread out amongst the globe. So you have to be very careful what you look at and what you invest in. But if you have the right criteria, then you can begin to see which ones are worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, how many companies are you sort of invested in at the moment then?
I think we're currently around 30. It's sort of VCing on speed, really. It's very, very quick because these tokens get liquid on the exchanges globally. As we all know, before the project's even done, at some point, in some ways, you can manage your risk before the project's even sort of underway. So you can get into a hype cycle, and it can do very well on the exchanges, and then you can have exited your position, not fully, of course, because we have a buy and hold strategy, but just in terms of being able to get out what you put in and then recycle that back into another project. So, you don't have to wait for a Series A or a Series B or anything like that. You can sometimes within a month you can have what you've put in out, and it's back into another project.
Yeah, well, do you know what? That's exactly what I do with my investments, you know, on small caps. I genuinely, you know, I don't overexpose myself to one stock, but I, you know, put money in. If it doubles, then I'll sell half and I'll use that as feed capital for other investments. And so I like that strategy. It works very well for me. But so you have 30 of these investments. Do you, I mean, even to me, that seems quite a lot. As in, do you think those companies will be, you know, all sustainable for long term?
Well, yes and no. So what's going on in this space is because we have this new technology, both not only just blockchain, like you know, Bitcoin, so a unit of value, but the whole smart contract world, wherein you're effectively creating programmable tokens that allow new types of businesses to exist. It's all one giant experiment. And really what we're doing is we're trying to find the best people in the space and back them. And there's many different sort of verticals, so that, you know, there's healthcare, finance, gaming, you know, you name it. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to pick the most credible teams in the most important verticals, and then those projects will live or die on how well they produce their MVPs and their communities and their businesses going forward. But clearly, we're not going to have, you know, 100% hit rate. But certainly, we hope that once you get tokens into the hands of many thousands of people globally around the world, and because these smart contracts are open source, because this whole technology is open source, once they get going, once they get the network effect, they're actually very difficult to catch, even if they make mistakes, because mistakes can be changed in the code as you go. So it was still a very, very early days, but it's not the same as, you know, a patented IP style web technology where, you know, you have a group of developers in a room, that's your tech, and people invest effectively to get your IP. This is a very different model to that, which makes it slightly unknown territory.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, take us through, say, I mean, maybe quickly, you know, one of your favorites at the moment you've recently invested in.
I think one of the favorites at the moment is probably Nexus Mutual. Nexus Mutual is a way of creating cover for smart contracts. It's not insurance as such. So people come together, they audit their smart contract code as one. There's a token that incentivizes that auditing process. And it's a way by which we can, the world can be more sure of the quality of the code, which is clearly something that's incredibly important because, you know, there's a lot of money riding on this code and it needs to be very carefully looked at. And Nexus Mutual, which is something we very recently got into, they have an absolutely brilliant team, is something that we feel that they're allowing a layer of security that's very much needed in the space.
Yeah, okay. And is the $16 billion question here, or the entire value. So going forward this year, I mean, do you think, I mean, we're sort of halfway through the year now, so obviously you can't really say anything specifically, but do you think 2018 will be as good for you as 2017?
Yes, indeed, it's the $16 million question. Well, I think I'm very positive. I think this is just the beginning, really. I think it's clear that some major institutions are beginning to take their positions. I think that when one looks at the sort of the number of wallets across the entire ecosystem that are in existence, I think the numbers are still comparatively very small. I think there's a huge number game here whereby I think a lot of people are still yet to come into the space. Whether that'll happen over the next year or so is hard to say, but certainly 2 years out, I'd imagine that we'd have had a huge, huge increase in the numbers of people participating. Yeah. I'd also say that it's incumbent upon the industry to start producing applications, decentralized applications that are working and actually performing a function, because I'll be honest, everything has up to this point sort of been benefit of the doubt. And we've actually got to see some of these moving. So I point towards projects like Funfair and Augur as being absolutely fascinating projects, which could completely change their industries. And they're about to switch on. So all eyes on them. And I think if they do well, then I'd be very bullish for this year and next.
Yeah. And then, do you know what, just one final thing. I mean, you must have now, because you've been in it for a while, longer than most people have known about it. But, I mean, when I'm investing, I do have now a strategy, and I have almost a tick box, it's in my head. So little tick boxes. Is that with you now, the same with you? Do you know what you're looking for?
Yeah. Yes and no. It's a mixture of different things. So we have. It's very often it's who hands you the project. So we have a global network of people who know the space very well, who we work with, and if they come through and say, look, we've seen this, we think it's very credible, then we'll take a look at it. Or it comes through our developer network, so we have a network of technical developers who are working in the space, and when they're excited, we get excited, because they understand the technology very deeply. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point when you start doing all the usual stuff. You look at the team, you look at the project, you look at the vertical, and you just begin to get a sense of how powerful this particular project could be, and we go from there, really. So it's sort of criteria and it's sort of feeling. Yeah. But very much, if something is advertising very, very heavily, be very, very careful. Because most of the stuff we see and most of the stuff we're interested in, no one's ever heard of, and they've never done a shred of advertising because they don't have to.
Yeah.
Haunt the forums. Haunt, have a Twitter feed of all the developers in the space. Follow the developers, because there's so much noise, and it is a pity. Because it does ruin it for a lot of us, but just try and stay away from the people who are shouting the loudest, and follow the people who are being the quietest.
So name somebody who shouts very loud.
Clearly you need to follow, Vitalik. Shouting loud.
Yeah.
If you switch on a YouTube video and someone is trying to the advert before you're trying to watch, someone play guitar solo or something, is someone trying to sell you, some kind of animal coin or something, just be skeptical.
Yeah. I see someone on Twitter who rants quite a lot and is kind of a well-known character. Do you know who I'm talking
about? Yes, there's a few. Well, there's so many. I probably wouldn't be able to pin down exactly who, but again, anyone who's taking money behind the scenes in order to sell something to their community is not worth following.
You
have to. Sorry, say again.
Who like?
Well, I think what's his name, Mr. The internet security guy. I can't remember
John
his name. McAfee.
That's the one I was thinking of. He seems to be talking about a crypto every day, and he's thinking
a crypto every day. I mean, I couldn't possibly comment on what his business situation is or how it works, but it's one of those things where I don't pay any attention, but clearly some do. So we are where we are.
Do you know what? It's very interesting you hear about your investment approach, because it is like that. I mean, that's what makes investing so interesting. It's a lot of qualitative data, but a lot of quantitative. So you could actually look at the criteria on certain things, and it stacks up. But then a lot of it's instinctive, and that's why for example, Warren Buffett. There's been books written on his investment techniques, but no one can do it like him, because there's that instinctive level that other people don't have. So you can teach it, but there's a certain amount of it that's just intrinsic. It's within and you can't have that.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something to be said for having been in this space a long time.
Yeah.
You've seen everything, really, and you do get a sense of what's legitimate and what's not.
Yeah. Excellent stuff. Marvellous. George, thanks for that. Before we go, three quick reasons why someone should add KR1 to their watch list, please.
Well, I think we've proven that we can pick a project or two. You can put our shares in an ISA, so you can get tax-free crypto gains, which is, I think we're the only company in the world where you can do that. Token-facing. I mean, of course, there are plenty of others you can, but it's token-facing. And what would the last one be? Well, we have a great network. We were the first token company in the world, a token investment company in the world, started in early 2016. Which, as we've been talking about, you know, as it's a tricky space to navigate, we're a good team to back.
Excellent stuff. Well, congratulations, George. Done well. So it's, you know, 4.2 million realized gain, and so 11.6 million profit for the year. That's fantastic for a company of 70 million market cap. It's figures that a lot of AIM companies would scream out for. So well done, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
That's very kind. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. All right, John.
Yes, good form. Thank you.
Now, as you're an award-winning mining analyst, it's always good to, you know, to pick your brain on certain bits of stuff that I don't know or other people don't know. And so this week, someone did mention it, because I saw a chart on Twitter about stocks or metals or minerals that are coming into good supply, so supply deficits are worth investing in, some that are oversupplied and overbalanced or whatever. And someone said to me, well, one of the best performing sort of metals or whatever is not on there. And I said, well, what is that? They said, vanadium. And so I know you covered it recently, and you can't get much exposure really to vanadium. I know you Bushveld has that, didn't they?
Bushveld have vanadium production. They're working their way up to about 5% of global supply. So they are right in the middle of this space.
Yeah, cool. And so, vanadium. Explain what it is, what it's going to be used for, why the price has risen so strongly of late.
Vanadium is principally used as a hardening alloy in steel. So steel rebar, which is used to strengthen concrete, and we're seeing a lot of that going into the Crossrail buildings around here, that's very important. And the Chinese recently increased the amount of vanadium that is required for Chinese rebar in order to try to make their buildings more earthquake-proof, in note of recent earthquake disasters in China. They're still not using as much vanadium as the European Union or the Americans, which use about three times as much as the Chinese. So I think Chinese regulations will continue to insist on increasing the amounts of vanadium to be used to strengthen that rebar and make those buildings, those new buildings, stronger. And as a result of that, the market has moved into a greater deficit situation than it has been in, because if we look at the charts, vanadium has actually been in a supply-demand deficit for some years, possibly since 2011. And so there's just not enough of it around. And if you combine those new regulations in China with their green shield and anti-pollution strategies, which are also causing a certain amount of vanadium supply to come out of the market, we can see why vanadium prices have more than doubled over the last 18 months, and we're currently at about $65 a kilo for ferrovanadium delivered into Europe. The peak price was something like 73. That was a little bit high. 65 is still quite a high price, but the market looks pretty solid at this level for now, and the fact that that the market's dipped back but actually is holding 65 is a very good sign going forwards.
Yeah, and vanadium redox batteries, what's all that about?
If we add in the development of vanadium redox batteries, then the market could go into very serious deficit, and which means that we're really not sure where all the vanadium is going to come from. Redox batteries are great for grid balancing, so in recent years, the Australians and the Americans have been putting lithium-ion batteries, big battery storage tanks, 20 megawatts, 50 megawatts, into their grid systems, and they're used to store electricity when the wind's not blowing for the wind farms, and when the sun's not shining for the solar farms, and so vanadium batteries, I think, will eventually take over from lithium-ion, because the parasitic losses on those batteries are lower, and I think the maintenance is going to be an awful lot less. They're very robust batteries. You don't need to change the vanadium within the battery for something like 10 years, and they operate very consistently through that period. So there's still a lot of trialing going on, but I think time will tell that this technology is better than the lithium-ion battery.
I see. So, of course, lithium's the one getting all the publicity, but people sort of in the know are realising that vanadium is really almost the next pretender to the throne, do you think?
Yes, I think on a cost basis it will outperform lithium for grid applications. You're not going to be seeing vanadium batteries in your electric vehicles or smaller applications. This is for big power stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Okay, and now a couple of weeks back, and we've got to cover it yet last week, but you started chatting about Bluebird Merchant Ventures, and you started talking about something. I was very interested in the process. I think we're talking about processing and metallurgy and all that stuff, and I asked you a question, and we got sidetracked. And this guy on Twitter said, why did you interrupt him? Why didn't you let him carry on talking about BMV? So can you just start again, John? Sorry, word for word, exactly what you were saying a couple of weeks back, and just update on those, please.
Well, I never like to repeat myself, but I'll summarise to some degree. A hugely experienced team. They've gone into South Korea. They are reopening a couple of old gold mines there. In fact, gold mines that produced very good grades and probably rather a lot of gold in their time. Neither mine has been exhausted by any means. They were closed at a time when gold prices were particularly low and when costs were clearly rising in that part of the world. Now that the gold prices are very, very much higher, these mines look like potentially economic prospects again. And the team have been in there. They've just been doing some metallurgical work. They show 90 to 97% recovery rates. They've done a lot of sampling within the mines, so they can show that there is, that certainly the broken rock piles within the mines are offering economic potential. And they've got good access into those mines, which was important because the mines had been very well sealed by the South Koreans. They really didn't want anyone going back into those mines while they were shut down. So the company has permission to go in. It's dewatered. It's cleaned things up. It's reorganized the access. And the next move really is just to work out a bit more on the economic potential, a bit more of a mining plan, and then really to get started. And I don't think it's going to cost them very much to do this because they'll start with a relatively modest scale gold production plant. There's nothing terribly clever about this. And they should start on a small scale in order to prove the operations up and then work out how to expand things from there.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous. And how long do you think that will take?
Well, I would have thought we'd see some form of small-scale production within 18 months. Till now, everything's been funded by management themselves. They've been very confident of what they can do and how quickly they can get in there. And they've not wanted to suffer any dilution. It's possible they may look to raise some money out of the market going forwards. But again, there's lots of options open to management teams like this because they are so close to some form of production. There are a variety of financing methods, but watch this space.
Marvellous stuff. That's BMV. John, thanks for that, and we'll catch up next week.
You're very welcome.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Connor Campbell, market analyst with Spreadex. You all right, Connor?
Very good, thank you.
All right, so you'll be looking at companies, bigger companies, reporting next week. So who are we starting with, Connor?
We've got AO World. It's their full year figures on Tuesday.
They had like a what's an advert? The advert is very catchy, isn't it, I think? Is it... A, O, let's go. It's very simple, but very catchy. I don't know if their trading is going as well. But go on, sorry, Connor.
Yeah. It's had a fairly good start to the year. I think it's sort of spiked to a 15-month high in mid-May of around 180. It's pulled back a bit since then. But it had this jump in mid-May that's sort of hard to explain. I was sort of doing a bit of digging and couldn't really find any one reason for it happening. Some people speculated it was sort of in response to the Ocado US deal that had happened the day before. But yeah, so it was from somewhere at least, a lot of investors poured in and sent it higher. Despite, you know, it sort of released an update in April that was fine, but not exactly, I guess, what you'd want maybe from an online retailer. I think revenue was strong. I think it's expecting full year revenue to come in £796 million, which is a 14% increase year on year and just above the midpoint of analyst forecast. And that was with an 8% rise in UK revenue, saying that it also said that it achieved growth in the fourth quarter, despite it being a competitive market and limited advertising spending, which shows, I guess, that perhaps the brand itself is becoming a bit stronger and doesn't need, you know, or at least that its catchy advertising that you're talking about has worked and doesn't need to spend quite as much money on that. And it can still, you know, translate that into growth. I think in Europe, it said that it's seen a 55% rise in revenue in the local currency as well. Obviously, it strengthened its hand there. However, I think it's still looking at an earnings loss of somewhere, I think analysts are speculating it'll be between 1.4 million and 9.7 million. I think against the 12 million loss last year, the company said it would be somewhere in the middle of that range. So I guess what it does on Tuesday is really going to be down to what side of the midpoint it falls on, really, whether that earnings loss is closer to 1.4 million or 9.7 million. Our clients, however, I think since it saw that spike in mid-May, they've been selling since it hit 180 and still as it's fallen back towards 160. I think, you know, it's climbed quite highly for a company that is facing an earnings loss. But, you know, it, like I said, it really depends. If it is closer to the 1.4 million end of the spectrum, then investors might be a bit kinder to it on Tuesday. But like I said, our clients selling around the 160 mark.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, towards the top end of the trading range, I'm not a buyer here. Definitely not. Especially just before news comes out. Because you always find, don't you, sort of companies, you know, rise in anticipation and then almost drop off, especially in the retail world. Okay, cool. That's 8-0 dot is the ticker there. What's next, Connor?
WH Smith, again, not doing too good. I think it hit a 7-month low in April after its half year results, and obviously recently it was voted the worst high street retailer by Which Readers, which obviously that, I think the stock had begun to sort of recover from those 7-month lows, and then that sort of gave it another knock last week. Its half-year figures, like I said, sparked those seven-month lows, despite being fairly just a sort of a standard modern-day WH Smith's update, really. Travel division, again, was the highlight. Total sales in that division were up 7%. Like-for-like is up 3%. In the high street division, obviously, it was the complete opposite. I think total sales fell 5%, with like-for-likes down 4%. The company blaming a lack of sort of emergent publishing trend to match the sort of the humour books of last year, and I guess the adult colouring books of the year previous to that. I think for the half year, you saw 1% drop in pre-tax profit to $82 million, which I guess was the key issue for investors, though WH Smith did try and sort of show that it was confident in the second half of the year by hiking its interim dividend by 10% to 16p per share. I think investors, it's its third quarter figures on Wednesday, investors are going to want to see an improvement in the high street, obviously perhaps back to the 3% decline it was maybe seeing last year. And I guess an acceleration in the travel division. I think full year in the travel division last year, I think it was like a 9% rise in total sales and 4% rise in like-for-like. So investors are going to want to see that travel division get back to that, especially given the expansion that division has seen in the last few months and is going to see in the second half of the year. Also, see, any sign of an emergent publishing trend will be welcome. If obviously, that is very hard to predict, especially, I guess, you know, we're only reaching the midpoint of the year. Those things aren't really going to come to a fore until around the holiday period. And that are obviously hard to predict. But I guess WH Smith will have their eyes set on that already, despite it being quite early. So any signs that that is improving as well will be welcome. From our clients' perspective, they are buying around the 1950 mark. I think like that 82, I think that £82 million figure, despite being a year-on-year drop, was fairly sudden. I think if I got it right, the company is still on track for like its third best like profit performance in 15 years. So, you know, that travel division is really helping it out and is incredibly strong. And again, as the sort of the balance in the company tips further towards that travel division, and you know, that becomes more and more the larger part of the company, you know, it does really have a grip in places like airports and train stations and things like that. So it's not, despite being a retail stock, and you know, it was all time highs at the end of last year, start of this year. So it is also, you know, it's pulled back somewhat, but that is arguably also just in reaction to it hitting those all time highs, not necessarily because it's doing horrendous or doing poorly in comparison to how it has been doing on the run up to those all time highs in 2017.
Yeah. I was really surprised they were nominated the worst shop, you know, on the high street. That surprised me. But I did. They've come in for a bit of flack actually, because I've been watching Hugh Furley Whittenstall's Fight the Fat, and he picked them out, and they were saying that you know, really criticising the way they're positioning all their chocolate, you know, right next to the tills and all that, and offering you three for twos and all this on really bad, unhealthy food. And literally, you're corralled in a sort of, you know, towards the sort of self-service tills by just boxes of chocolate. You know, it's surrounding you. You know, as far as your eyes can see, it's like up and down. And he criticised them. And they said, oh, we don't sell a lot of chocolate. We only supply something like 2% of the UK market, which it works out, it's about 90 bars every second or something ridiculous. So it's they do sell a lot. Anyway, fella, cool. That's WH Smith. Anything else?
Yeah, finally we've got Mai Tai Mitty Group on Thursday. It's there for your figures on Thursday.
Yeah, how do you say that?
Obviously,
Mitty or Mighty? Mitty,
yeah, Mighty not quite group. Sure.
Or Mighty Group, yeah.
Obviously, outsourcing industry not had a great time of it in the last few months or in 2018. Sort of the company has you know, felt the effects of that. I think it was at like 13-year lows by mid-March. It has bounced back since then. I think it hit 5-month high of like, it briefly hit like 198 towards the end of May. The CEO admitted as much that it's a tough time to be in the industry. He said that the collapse of Carillion had raised fundamental questions about the sector, whilst sort of trying to, you know, distance itself from the way Carillion's business was structured. I think in terms of what they're expecting on Thursday, it said that revenue is expected to rise 2% to 2.5% to around £2.2 billion. And it said that it's got a solid order book at the moment, boosted by, I think it was a £525 million like 10-year contract for like detention and escorting in its care and custody division, which I think has sort of doubled that division with that just that one contract. However, investors sort of were put off with this update back in March, due to the fact that the cost of Project Helix, which is the company's transformation program, it's sort of designed to deliver, I think, $50 million in savings by 2020, would cost the company £35 million in, you know, the current year, compared to the £24 million guidance it previously said, which is, you know, that's a fairly big increase. Despite that £50 million cost saving, I think that was a 10% increase on the previous guidance for that as well. In terms of operating profit as well, I think that's expected to be slightly down on the previous year due to investment, I think, in its customers and its infrastructure and things like that. How, given that the operating profit had seen a near 14% decline, between 4 year 15-16 and 16-17, that doesn't bode well for it. I think it was around £82 million last year. So investors are going to want to see a very, very marginal dip in that operating profit, given that it was, you know, sort of heftily downgraded last year. In terms of our clients, they're fairly undecided around the 180 mark. I think, you know, it has fallen, especially if you go back to like start of last June, that's when the decline really set in. It's fallen very sharply since then. So there is, you know, room for it to bounce back without it having to produce particularly amazing results. But again, it is a sector that has quite a lot of dark clouds around it at the moment. I think that's perhaps why our clients were a bit hesitant to go sort of full hog back into the stock. So like I said, undecided around 180 mark, maybe just about erring on buying, but almost a 50-50 split between the clients that are interested in the company.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Connor, so it's MTO the ticker there, so I don't know how they go from Mighty to MTO. There we go, I don't know how to pronounce it even. But thanks for that, Connor. Have a nice weekend and speak next week.
You too, thanks very much.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Bizant Resources, that's BZT, did a placing yesterday, quite discounted. But of course, it would be, it's, you know, a high-risk exploration company in the Philippines. And They raised a sort of, what, £800,000 to advance that project. Massive copper asset. Massive. Absolutely. But they've had a letter and also a renewal of their work commitment from the environment their agency there in the Philippines. So it looks quite good there, because it was, that was in doubt earlier in the year, but there's been a change of ministry there. You know, worth checking out. At 4, Alpha Growth PLC, ALGW. At 3, ADL, it's Andalas Energy and Power. At 2, Farn, or Farn Pharmaceuticals, F-A-R-N. And number one most followed company was MySquare, M-Y-S-Q. Okay, time for the top five most liked RNSs. At 5, Alpha Growth, appointment of Chief Operating Officer. At 4, MySquare Limited, exercise of convertible bonds and issue of equity. At 3, i3 Energy, final results. At 2, Horizonte Minerals, award of options. And number one most liked RNS came from Feedback, appointment of new medical director. And it's another excellent appointment. A guy really high up, well connected. He's called Rory Shaw, and highly experienced NHS executive. And like I said recently, it seems like they are building, you know, a board of a FTSE 250, FTSE 100 company here. Really strong, you know, well-connected, experienced players in this field. So it's one to keep an eye out on, Feedback FDBK. Okay, let's look at the top five. Oh, sorry, that wasn't top five RNSs, wasn't it? Yeah, sorry. That's what I'm talking about. It's been a long week, obviously. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.